The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right, we made it to a Friday, so another week is coming to a close, and that's a good thing. Welcome to it, everybody. I'm Nicole Sandler, coming to you live at NicoleSandler.com, on the Progressive Voices Network, on internet stations like Netroots Radio and Air Progressive, also streaming video at on YouTube, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Twitch. So lots of ways to get the show. And, of course, the podcast is available after it ends. No paywall here. We survive on your donations, and I supplement my income by painting pet portraits and things like that. So lots of ways to support the show. Lots more ways to listen or watch, and however you choose to do it, I thank you for that. So this is an interesting, weird day. Because 20 years ago tomorrow, you don't need me to tell you, is the 20th anniversary, was 9/11, the terrorist attacks of 9/11. And, you know, last night, David and I started watching the show that's on Netflix. It's a multi-part series. It's called Turning Point, 9/11 and the War on Terror. And I got to tell you, just the opening sequence alone, I got a visceral reaction. I got that feeling in the pit of my stomach. It brought me back 20 years. And I'll tell you something, it doesn't feel like 20 years. It feels like this just happened yesterday because it's still so fresh in my mind. And so let me share with you, let me tell you what's coming up on the show today. Tom Hartman's going to be here at the bottom of the hour. He's got a new book out. I think it's his 3087th or something like that. And it's about, well, it's, you know, he's got this hidden history series. So this one's The Hidden History of American Healthcare. I got a lot of things flagged in here. So we'll talk to Tom Hartman about that. And of course, other things because of what today is, right? So, all right. So 20 years ago, I was living in Los Angeles. And I had just adopted my daughter, Allison. In fact, I brought Allison home from Kazakhstan December of 2000, right? So now we're talking about September of 2021. I was working for the company at the time was Clear Channel. And when I went to Kazakhstan to adopt Allison, the station in Los Angeles was known as Channel 103.1. That's where I worked. And this was right when the internet was picking up steam, right? The dot-com boom. Remember that in 2000? So I was the music director, and then I became program director. And all of a sudden, I get the call. I have this child is in Kazakhstan waiting for me to go there and bring her home. So I went over, kept a journal online, came back home with my new daughter living in Los Angeles, and just about a month or two later, we got the word that Clear Channel was selling our station because it was the age of consolidation and the big broadcasting companies were busy buying and selling and trading like it was, you know, baseball cards or something. So this was as I told you, this is when the dot-com boom was happening. So my general manager, a wonderful man named Charlie Riley, and I talked about it and we pitched Clear Channel on letting us take this station from over the air, knowing we were going to be sold and go off the air, to be the first station to go seamlessly from terrestrial radio, we didn't use that term back then, but over the air radio, to internet only. And go figure, Clear Channel went along with it. So we did. And I don't remember the exact date. I mean, I've got tons of like articles and things here. We were featured in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, the Chicago Tribune, and of course, all the LA papers. CNN came out and did a thing when we did the changeover from over the air to internet only. We made national news. We were blazing new horizons, right? Early days of internet radio. And at this point, people were still on dial up. So it was 2000. It was still very early. And so we went through, we wound up moving to another building. We bought, Clear Channel bought this other company called, I can't think of the name of the company, but it was run by Bob Ezrin. Bob Ezrin, legendary music producer. He produced Pink Floyd's The Wall. He produced but Bob Ezrin, look him up someday. So he was running this internet radio company. They had Luxurium Music. I think they had KNAC.com. And then we went over there. We were Channel 103.1. We became WorldClassRock.com. And so we were all under this one heading. Clear Channel had bought out Bob Ezrin's company, but he was still there. God, it's going to bug me until I can remember the name of this company. And so, anyway, so we're going, moving along at a, you know, it's, we're making progress, but it was the very early days of internet radio. And then the dot-com bust happened. You remember that, right? Everything just, it all was upended. It all just died. And Clear Channel had to cut costs. And I was making decent money then. And I was one of the first casualties. So there I am. I'm in LA. I have an amazing house in Culver City. I had just adopted Allison. So I have a toddler at home. And all of a sudden I'm told, thanks, but your services are no longer needed. I'm like, what? So it was a lot. To make a long story short, they wound up paying me a year's salary as severance. Thank you for your service. Goodbye. Here's some money. Go away. So I thought, all right, let's see what I can do. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had no idea. I decided that I was going to move to Taos, New Mexico. Don't ask. My head is fucked up sometimes. And so I was offered a job to program and do mornings at a very cool AAA station. That's the music that I played in Taos called K-Taos, solar-powered radio in Taos. And I'm thinking, I'll be like Earth Mother. I can go and have a life there. And my kid. Well, the thing is, you can't go culture. But that's neither here nor there because I'm getting ahead of myself. The morning of Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, we were supposed to have a realtor's open house in my beautiful house in Culver City, California, that I was going to sell to move to Taos. And I'm sleeping, and the phone rings, and it's the realtor, and he says, hell of a day for an open house, huh? And I just said, what's the matter? Is it raining? And he said, oh, you're not awake yet. We've been attacked. The World Trade Center is on fire. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He said, turn on the television. And I did. And I remember it as clearly as if it were yesterday. I was stunned. And the thing is, after a career in radio, when there's a major catastrophe, you go into the radio station. When you work in media, that's what you do. When we had the big Northridge quake in LA, I was off that day. And my car was stuck in the garage because I had no power, but a neighbor drove me to the station because that's what you do in this business. I had no radio station to go to. I had been out of work literally for 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. And I was Enigma Digital. Thank you, Karina. That was it. Enigma Digital. That was the name of it. That was the name of the internet company that Bob Ezrin had, where we had the internet radio stations. It was in Santa Monica. It was lovely little studios. Anyway, I digress. So I'm just like, okay, I guess we're not having an open house today. Oh my God, we're at war. And I'm sitting there just, you know, glued to the television. Allison at this point is 2. She's a baby. She doesn't know what's going on. And I am, you know, I'm freaked out. And I didn't know what to do with myself again, because I didn't have work to do. So I went through it. I dealt with the day. I had all, but it's so weird watching this thing on Netflix, this movie Turning Point. I felt the same sickness in my stomach, and it's not just your typical nausea. I had a visceral reaction last night. We're watching this. And I'll tell you something. The whole opening sequence is of the, you know, 20 minutes or so between when the first plane hits And when the second plane hits, and then the walls, you know, the buildings come down. And I watched it unfold after I, you know, was wakened abruptly from a sleep. I went into like disbelief mode, not, and thinking at that point, well, shit, now I really better get out of LA because who knows where they're going to hit next. And if they hit New York, LA can't be far behind. And I thought, Taos, New Mexico, that's a place to go. That's off the grid. We'll be safe there. I was paranoid. Nobody knew what to think. So I'm going through the day. And there's Allison. And obviously, she didn't know what was going on, but she knew I was upset. Well, one thing that we did back in those days to, you know, together to pass the time was we watched a couple of TV shows. Yeah, she did Sesame Street and all that. But her two big shows when she was little were Dora the Explorer and Blue's Clues. So something happened this week. Now, I don't know if you are familiar with Blue's Clues, but Blue's Clues was huge. So right around 2000, 2001, Allison was of that age, 2 years old or so, and that was her favorite show. And there was something about it that was very endearing. In fact, here I'm going to, for those of you watching on one of the video streams, here is a picture of Allison. I think in this photo, she's about four, and it was a Halloween. We were here in Florida by that time, so she must have been four. And she's dressed up as Magenta, who is another dog in the show Blue's Clues. She's the girl. And that's her cousin Dylan, who's Blue. So the idea behind Blue's Clues is that Blue was a dog owned by Steve Burns, who was everybody's best friend. And Steve would, you know, get clues. They'd solve a mystery on each show. And they had songs that go along with it. This was such an important part of our lives when she was growing up. She had everything. She had the handy dandy notebook. She had the mailbox. She had the different characters. She was Magenta for Halloween. She had the toys, the stuffed toys. So this week, we're going through, you know, these jolts of memory, and they are emotional, right? It's going back through the memories of 9/11. If it doesn't affect you in a visceral way, then you probably weren't around. Like Allison was over for dinner the other night. We were talking about it, and I said, I know you don't remember because you were too little. But do you know about it? And she said, well, all I really know is that we were attacked and that planes flew into a big office building. And so we were explaining to her what went on because, you know, I don't even think they teach it in schools. So, you know, so the other day I'm tooling around on the internet doing what I do. And I see a video that Steve from Blue's Clues resurfaced to tell us where he went. Because when Steve left Blue's Clues, seriously, the world stopped for a few minutes. And all he said was, I'm going off to college. This is my little brother, Joe. He's your new best friend. And by that time, you know, Allison was kind of outgrowing Blue's Clues. And so, you know, I didn't think much about it. But that was close to 20 years ago. So we're going through all this stuff. Now, I just got to show you this video. Because even people who didn't watch Blue's Clues have been moved by this video. So this video. Oops, hold on. I got something up. Why do I have some volume up? Where's the volume coming from? Come on. I hate when I do this. That's muted. That's okay. Maybe it's from there. Ooh. All right. Let's try this. Okay, that did the trick. All right, so here is the message from Steve. Now, when Steve left, he was a young 20-something guy with a lot of hair. Now it's like 20 years later. And this is what has brought grown men and women to tears. All right, and it surprised the hell out of me.
Hi. You got a second?
It's Steve!
You remember how when we were younger, we used to run around and hang out with Blue and find clues talk to Mr. Salt, freak out about the mail and do all the fun stuff. And then one day I was like, oh, hey, guess what? Big news. I'm leaving. This is my brother, Joe. He's your new best friend. And then I got on a bus and I left. and yeah. we didn't see each other for like a really long time.
Yeah.
Can we just talk about that?
Okay. Okay.
Great.
Okay.
Because I realized that was kind of abrupt.
Yeah.
I just kind of got up and went to college. And that was really challenging, by the way, but great because I got to use my mind and take a step at a time, and now I literally am doing many of the things that I wanted to do.
Wow.
And then look at you, and look at all you have done, and all you have accomplished in all that time. And it's just so amazing, right? I mean, we started out with clues.
Yeah, clues.
And now it's what? Student loans. And jobs, and families, and some of it has been kind of hard.
Yeah.
You know?
I know.
I know you know.
I know.
And I wanted to tell you that I really couldn't have done all of that without your help.
Oh. Oh.
And in fact, all the help that you helped me with when we were younger is still helping me today, right now.
Wow.
And that's super cool.
Oh.
I guess I just wanted to say that after all these years, I never forgot you.
Oh.
Ever. And I'm super glad we're still friends.
Oh, my God.
Thanks for listening.
Oh, thanks for listening.
You look great, by the way.
Oh, thank you too, Steve.
Whatever it is you're doing, it's working.
Except he's bald now. So it's the 25th anniversary of Blue's Clues, and that's what this is about. And I guess they're rebooting it. I don't think he joined the military. I think Steve, he's a singer-songwriter, and he went off to try to do that, but we never heard from him again. And once the brother, Joe, took over, Allison didn't watch it anymore, and I guess they're rebooting it now with a third guy who, you know, plays with Blue and solves the mysteries, uses the clues, writes them in the handy dandy notebook. And you know, there used to be a song for when the mail came. There's mail, and I'm drawing a blank because it's been about 20 years. But I saw a clip that they had on one of the shows that the new guy, and he sings about we got an email instead of a letter. So times change. But that is such a slice of life and memories from that time. So you got the warm, fuzzy memories from Blue's Clues. And of course, I had to dig out the picture of Allison and Dylan in their blue and magenta Halloween costumes. Isn't that so cute? Oh, my goodness. And juxtapose that with the feeling, with 9/11. Now, in What's News Today, I put a tiny little clip at the very end of something that I did, because on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, I was working at WINZ in Miami. And I, you know, then because it was part of Clear Channel, also Clear Channel, go figure, I could play music on the show and not get copyright violated. Then again, I wasn't streaming video. And at the time, I don't know if you remember, shortly after, you know, the dust cleared a little bit, they had a big concert for heroes in New York at Madison Square Garden, and they televised it, and it raised money for the first responders and all that. And it was everybody from The Who to Springsteen to, you know, every big name imaginable. And a friend of mine, a guy named John Ondrasik, who really was a band called Five for Fighting. He's still recording under Five for Fighting, but it's all him. His name is John Ondrasik, and he had a song that was out at the time called Superman. And it goes something, the lyrics are, I can't stand to fly. I'm not quite naive. Men weren't made to fly with clouds between their knees. And again, I'm doing this off the top of my head, but it's about Superman, and it's about being a father. And the firefighters and the first responders at 9/11 glommed onto that song as an anthem of sorts. And John was a friend of mine, so he came on the air with me on the 10th anniversary and talked about it. And I had done this audio montage using clips of the song with the actualities of the first responders. And and I can't play it for you because I'll get copyright violated. I'll tell you what, though, I will post one of those vignettes, one of those montages on the show, on the blog where I post the show. So it'll be at NicoleSandler.com/9-10-21. That's today's date. That's how I post, you know, the each podcast on the website. So I'll post that there so you can hear it. But at the very end of today's What's News, I used a little piece, another montage I had put together using Jeff Buckley's version of Hallelujah. And hopefully this won't get me violated. Here's how it goes.
It's not a victory march. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah. Hallelujah.
All units, be advised, the North Tower is leaning. Move your operations north of the tower.
Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Oh, my
God!
They're both down now.
You know, the emotions go from one extreme to another. I used to, you know, do stuff with music, so I mixed the audio over the music because that's how I could express myself. Obviously, I can't do that now, but again, I'll post that. But that's what I'm going back to, is feeling that. And, you know I want to watch some of these shows because I need to understand as much as we can understand what happened. And I thought, well, I remember it so well, I don't need to relive it. But the way watching that last night, the way I felt it in the pit of my stomach, it brought back all those horrible feelings. So I got something else I want to share with you to maybe make you feel a little better. There's a book, and I'm mad at myself that I didn't think about this until now, but there's a book written by my former colleague at WINZ in Miami, Jim Defeatty, who is a major Florida journalist. These days, he works for CBS4. He's their main political guy. He does Facing South Florida every Friday morning. But back in 2001, he read about all the planes that were diverted to Nova Scotia. And he went up there, he met the people, and he wrote an amazing book called The Day the World Came to Town. Now, when I got the book years later, after I started working with Jim, I couldn't put it down. I read it in literally 24 hours. I could not put it down. And it renewed my faith in humanity. Seriously. It was just heartwarming and wonderful. And it's the true story of the people whose planes, they were in the air when the towers were hit. And their planes were diverted to Gander, Newfoundland. And they were stuck there for a few weeks. And the town of Gander, Newfoundland took in these people. And the stories that Jim told in this book stay with me. Well, there's a Broadway musical called, Come Away From Here. I'll get it. I can't believe I'm drawing a blank on it. Come From Away. It's called Come From Away. Big Broadway musical that is not, I made the mistake of saying it was inspired by Jim's book. No, obviously it was inspired by the events of 9/11. But Jim was, you know, they used some of his stories. And so now there's a new updated version of the book, The Day the World Came to Town, that's just out, I think, last week. So I spoke to Jim today, you know, of course, me, the space cadet. He's going to join us a week from Monday, so on the 20th. So we'll talk about that and a lot of other things. But the other thing I want to tell you is, one, read the book. It will renew your faith in humanity, really. At a time when you might be down about people, hello, I know I am, this book will just restore your faith. And I've heard only amazing things about the play Come From Away. Well, Apple TV has a televised version of it that they premiere tonight or today. It may be live already. So that's something you can do this weekend if you can't. I mean, a lot of people are feeling like PTSD from watching the video again. I mean, remember, in the immediate aftermath, the planes hitting the World Trade Center were played over and over and over again on the television. And we're all like, stop it already, because it doesn't help. So, you know, it's bringing back floods of memories and bad memories. And so it's just a different perspective on 9/11 and how these people in the town of Gander, Newfoundland, opened their homes and their lives to strangers who were stranded there. I'm telling you, if you need something to pull you out of the depression of reliving 9/11, read The Day the World Came to Town and watch Come From Away. I know I'm going to watch it probably tonight. All right. Tom Hartman's going to be joining us in a few minutes, but I think we have time for a call, and we've got one coming in. Hi, who's this? Oh,
hi,
I didn't mean to hit the applause button.
Michael from New York City.
Hey, Michael from New York City. It's been a long time.
It has been a long time. Right now, excuse me, I'm up in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, on a small vacation with the wife, and we had like a small family reunion here.
Uh-huh.
I have family living in Cape Cod, and it's nothing like family, I'm telling you. Especially, I was so moved by your recollecting of what happened with 9/11 and how it affected everyone. And I thought I had to call in because I was watching MSNBC earlier today.
Yeah.
And they were doing a compare and contrast between 9/11 then and 9/11 now in terms of the Republicans.
Uh-huh.
Now, back 20 years ago, we were all shaken by what took place in New York City.
Yeah.
I mean, my wife and I saw it on television, mm-hmm. the planes hitting the towers and the towers collapsing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And everyone was in cooperation as to getting down to the bottom as to how the hell something like that could have happened. And then we saw that there were some Republicans that only wanted to go up to a certain point of investigating and getting to the truth. And then they started getting into the cover-ups, if you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you look at what occurred just earlier this year, January 6th,
yeah.
Not one regular Republican wants to touch on what the hell happened, and they persist on letting Mr. 45 off the hook after we have audio and video showing him inciting that very crowd, that very mob, to do what they did to U.S. Capitol,
yeah.
Even attacking police. The same police that Republicans are now on record and have been called out for using cops as props, as Val Demings from Florida, who was a police officer herself, calling out these Republicans.
Right.
So
okay.
We are at the point of really putting our foot down and demanding truth and justice as to what happened then. The vaccinations that's still affecting, I shouldn't say vaccinations, but the virus, COVID virus, that's still affecting us. I mean, Republicans are the ones that want to hurt this nation. I don't know what the hell the problem is, but it is despicable and it's anti-civil, anti-American. And we say, never forget 9/11.
Right.
Yeah, never forget who passed on, but never forget the lessons that's supposed to be taught to us. Am I not correct?
No, you know, you are correct. And it seems like things have just steamrolled since then. Unfortunately, everything changed, I think, on 9/11. And Bin Laden, when you look back on it, got what he wanted. I mean, our society was affected in a big way. Nothing has been the same since. And so I don't know that you can connect today's Republican Party to that, although certainly you can, because it's all interconnected. And look, they're the ones who got us into that mess.
Still around now.
Right. I think about what would have happened if Al Gore had rightfully taken the Oval Office, because, you know, he did win the popular vote in 2000. Things, I think, would be so wholly different. Both on 9/11, who knows what would have, I mean, we can't go back and say it wouldn't have happened. Although there's a good chance it wouldn't have happened. We don't know. I just know, I think the world would be very different now. But I do the woulda, coulda, shouldas all the time. Doesn't help at all. So you got to figure out how to get past it. We got to figure out what to do about today's Republican Party, because this is nothing I imagined even 20 years ago. Hey, Michael, I'm going to run because I got Tom Hartman standing by. It's nice to hear from you.
Stay safe.
Thank you. You too. All right. You take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right. Michael from, I think, from the Bronx. Right. It's been a long time. All right. So I mentioned Tom Hartman was going to be along today, and he is here. Tom, always great to see you, and thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back.
Hey, Nicole. It's great to see you. It's great to be here with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And thank you for always joining us. So you release a new book, it seems like, about every 6 months. I may be exaggerating it. I just think you don't sleep. You just go.
I try to write 4 or 5 hours a day.
Wow.
And you do a
3-hour radio show a day. I don't know how you do it.
I don't have a life.
I understand. I gotcha. So the new book is The Hidden History of American Healthcare, Why Sickness Bankrupts You and Makes Others Insanely Rich. And this one, obviously, I'm interested in all your books because they're all fascinating. But this one affects us all in more personal ways than some of the others. I mean, monopolies are important, but healthcare, we all have, skin in this game. And so I read it with great interest. Now, so much of this is recent history. We lived through it just 10, 11 years ago. We were both, on the air at the time on Air America when the Affordable Care Act was being written in a number of different committees, and it was a year-long process, and it was painful, and it finally passed, and it wasn't what we had hoped it would be throughout the entire negotiations. But you actually start further back, and we'll get to that. But the introduction, I always enjoy reading author introductions because it's sort of a little addendum to the book. And in your introduction, you're talking about COVID, here we are, and the introduction is titled How a Single Payer Healthcare System Helped Stop COVID-19. And you tell the story of Taiwan and how Taiwan navigated this pandemic. And while infections are blowing up everywhere, Taiwan held it down to almost single digits for most of that time.
That's correct. As of day before yesterday, Taiwan has had a total of 837 deaths for the entire year and a half.
Right. Now, I got to show you because I pulled up some graphs. So this is interesting. This is daily new cases here. Total coronavirus cases in Taiwan. Look at this graph. Up until... my eyes are not good. Up until April of this year, they really had nothing. Can you see that? It's like a blip.
And then that's when the Delta variant
came in. And all of these graphs that I pulled, it's all the same thing. This is daily new cases in Taiwan. They had a big spike, but it looks like it's back down again to almost nothing. And active cases in Taiwan, same thing. I mean, they all correspond.
And those almost all came into the country. I mean, there's a lot of air traffic that goes through Taiwan. It's an island nation. So these are mostly not endogenous care, internal cases. These are visitors bringing Delta COVID.
So Tom, how were they able to do that? How were they able to hold it off for so long while the rest of the world was exploding in this pandemic and we were all locked down and yet cases were just replicating exponentially? How did Taiwan do it?
They have what is probably the cleanest, most efficient single-payer system in the world. Mm. And in part because it's relatively new, in the last 40 years or so. I had to go back and look at my own book and see when they put it into place. But there was an American professor from Princeton who went over there as the country was making the transition from a military dictatorship into a democracy, and gave a speech about single payer healthcare, and they hired him to write their system. He did. They put it into place, and boom, that was it. Off to the races. So when you're born in Taiwan, you are given an ID card, a number like our Social Security number that you can get at birth here in the United States. You're given an ID card that you can use to access your medical records from any computer anywhere in the world. You can use it to pay for, to check yourself into a hospital, to visit a doctor, to pay for your pharmaceuticals. It is complete. And so because they had this national database and everybody was in it and everybody's medical history was in it and everything that was going on was there. They're a very technologically advanced nation They're one of the major developers of microchips around the world. And, mm-hmm. They make a lot of electronics and stuff. They were able to put into place. We got our first COVID case a little more than a year and a half ago, January 20th,
right.
of 2020. And they got their first a day later, January 21st. At the end of a year, we had 500,000 dead people and they had maybe a dozen.
Wow.
And because they were able to put into place within a matter of weeks, a testing and contact tracing system that was so efficient that they could isolate, they caught every single case. They were able to isolate it, let it die out, let these people recover, back into society and keep their island disease free for a year.
Amazing. It's amazing. And they had this big spike when the Delta variant hit, but it looks like they got it under control fairly quickly to now the graph is down to where it was before. And we have nothing of the sort over here. Now, I know there are a lot more people in the U.S. than in Taiwan, but it just shows that when you have a system in place that takes care of people, it can work. It can take care of people.
Well, the other thing that it shows is that in the United States, we always have treated individual health and family health as kind of one category. And we have one kind of professional, doctors and like that. And then public health as a completely separate category. You can get an MPH degree, Master's of Public Health, if you're going to work in public health. And in fact, my son was a public health officer for a county in Washington state. We treat them as they're separate things. In Taiwan, they're the same thing. It's all one thing. And that's the case in most of the other developed countries in the world. And single payer systems make that just seamless, make it very easy. And so, therefore, they're super resilient when it comes to dealing with something like a pandemic.
Wow. Before we move on, I want to read a paragraph from the book. It's on page 53, and it's under the heading of America, the Land of the Sick. And you write, America is the only developed country in the world that doesn't recognize healthcare as a human right. The only country with more than 2/3 of its population lacking access to affordable healthcare. And the only country in the developed world that has, since its founding, continuously enslaved and legally oppressed and disenfranchised a large minority of its population because of their race. This says so much, right? This is the problem that's endemic here. And it didn't have to be this way. So you do go back, you start with the history of healthcare in the United States. And I didn't realize, I learned so much from you all the time, Tom Hartman, that there's always been this battle. There are those who wanted a single payer, like a Medicare for all system, although it wasn't called that back then. And there are those who fought against it. And they even use the old tropes of, oh, it's socialism or it's government control. That's the stuff that they were saying back then. So some things don't change. That's incredible.
Yeah. Germany got their first, Germany got a national healthcare system, a single payer national healthcare system in 1884. And this is before they were even a federal republic. They were still the German Empire. And it was Otto von Bismarck,
right.
Who was no liberal.
No.
And he wanted to use it to make his military strong and his populace healthy. And he just came right out and said, it's the most efficient way to do it. It's the least expensive, most efficient. And it's going to work. And it did work. And, people in the United States were pushing for this. They kind of hit a peak in 1912 when Teddy Roosevelt proposed his Square Deal. Mm. And one piece of the Square Deal was a national healthcare system. And, in 1937 or 36, Franklin Roosevelt proposed, it never got to a formal proposal, but, brought this up proposed it, let's say. In 1947, Harry Truman explicitly tried to get through a single payer healthcare system. John Kennedy in 1961. And then finally in 65, we got Medicare through Lyndon Johnson. But the thing that was blocking it from the 1880s to the 1980s for that 100 years, that century, the thing that blocked us from having, that caused us to be the only developed country in the world that doesn't define healthcare as a right and therefore doesn't have the government backstop it and make sure everybody has it, was racism. Mm-hmm. And it was this, and there's one major pivotal player at the center of this, a guy named Frederick Ludwig Hoffman, who came over to the United States from Germany in the 1880s at the age of 17 with $5 in his pocket. And he was a math savant, a math genius. And he got a gig with the Prudential Life Insurance Company doing, running numbers on life insurance risks so they could figure out, you know, what to charge people and who to write policies for. And he was the guy who discovered that there was a statistical association between working in the cotton mills and having fibrosis of the lungs, smoking cigarettes and getting lung cancer, and being exposed to asbestos and getting mesothelioma. And he co-founded the American Lung Association. He discovered that there was an association between eating a diet high in processed foods and cooked foods and cancer.
Wow.
And that book that he wrote about that is still in print in 2021. And he's been dead since 1946. So he was very well known, very well thought of. And he traveled around the country talking about these issues and working for the Prudential Company. And his he married this Southern belle down in Georgia, whose family had a kind of plantation history. And he decided to apply his statistical skills to the problem of race in America, which was also something that the Prudential was interested in, because they charged different amounts for black people versus white people.
Right.
And they were looking for justification. When they started writing, ultimately, policies for black people, for a long time, they just refused to write the policies. And what he concluded, he wrote a book. It was published in 1896, the same year that we got Plessy versus Ferguson, legal apartheid in the United States. And his book was called Race Traits and Tendencies of the American Negro. And his conclusion was that black people were healthy during slavery, but no longer healthy in the 1890s. And that was because they were genetically inferior. And if we simply deny them health care for a couple of generations, they will all die out. And that will solve the race problem in America.
Oh, my God.
And that logic was used against Teddy Roosevelt in 1912 to shoot down his square deal. That logic was adopted by Woodrow Wilson and became part of the eugenics program in the United States in the 1920s that Hitler picked up and turned into the final solution.
Oh,
that
boy.
Logic was used to shoot down Harry Truman's 1947 efforts. That logic was used in 1965 when Lyndon Johnson and Robert Ball were writing the Medicare law. The Southern white Southern racist senators, they were Democrats back then, came forward and said, we want to make sure if you're going to give free health care to people over 65 and you're going to make it universal for people over 65, that's going to include black people. We want to make sure that they can't afford to use it. So they built this 20% gap in the Medicare on the assumption that poor black people would not be able to afford that 20%. And so they wouldn't present themselves in the hospitals. And because it applies to Part B, which is the hospital reimbursement. And that's why we have to buy Medigap policies today. But they were quoting, in 1965, they were quoting Hoffman.
Wow.
So, you know, this racism, this he called it scientific racism in the 1920s. And he became a vice president of the Prudential Company, traveled around the country, testified before Congress, did major tours, spoke to huge audiences, was feted by the, you know, loved by the American Medical Association and everybody. I mean, he was a big deal, a name that nobody knows now.
No.
Everybody in the 1930s knew who Frederick Hoffman was. And that's so right up until the 1980s, that's why we didn't have a national healthcare system. Since the 80s, when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act in 1983, and we went from hundreds of small health insurance companies to about a dozen large ones, these health insurance companies acquired so much power and so much profit that they could easily buy politicians and lobby and buy legislation. And so they've been the major obstacle since the 1980s to a national healthcare system.
But even before then, I mean, the fear campaign, obviously Ronald Reagan came into office in, I think, 1980, but it was back in the 60s, I guess, when Lyndon Johnson was trying to put this through, and even earlier, that Reagan, then an actor, recorded an album that in which it was they put it on an old record player, it's vinyl, in which he talks about the dangers of socialism and Medicare. You can still find it. It's on YouTube. It's everywhere. And yeah. But that
my dad had one.
Did he? Wow.
Yeah, he was a Republican activist.
Oh my. So but those scare tactics go way back. In fact, FDR wanted in the New Deal to include insurance when they got Social Security through. But as you write, he said, you know, this would kill off the whole thing. I love that you gave a lot of ink to Frances Perkins, because she's another name. Look, we may not know Frederick Hoffman, but we don't know enough about Frances Perkins either. And we should. She should be. She should be, you know, taught in every history class to kids. And she's really not. She's the unsung hero of the New Deal.
She's the author of the New Deal. I mean, she was the first female labor secretary in the history of the United States. She was a good friend of Eleanor Roosevelt. Yep. She became a good friend of Franklin Roosevelt. And she was the force behind the New Deal. There's a marvelous biography of her. I think it's called Frances Perkins, The Woman Behind the New Deal. And that is, you just can't put it down. I mean, it's like reading a thriller.
Somebody needs to do a movie about her. She needs to be brought into the forefront, because she was a hero and she's just not out front in the history books, or her story is not taught as it should be. So I was glad you
and she was fighting for health insurance.
Right.
You know, it was an unsuccessful battle that she fought for.
So when we finally got it, and you know, you explain why that 20% gap is in there, and hopefully we'll have time and get to that. So then fast forward. So now it's, you know, the early 2000s or the late 2008, Obama gets into office and he's going to get us health care. And you have Bernie Sanders on one side, who used to do a weekly thing on your show and talk about Medicare for all. And I think that's when most people in this era started really paying attention because of Bernie Sanders. Cause he's like, we need to do this. The paragraph I read, he's been singing that song ever since I heard of him before. So then we get to the point where Obama's in office, and the year that was spent writing and negotiating and in three different committees, the bill goes through, and the public option was there through the whole time. It was always talked about. So we weren't going to get Medicare for all, but if you wanted to buy into Medicare and not pay the what I call the for-profit insurance company extortion fees, you could buy in and just pay the Medicare costs and the public option. And then when push came to shove, it was killed. You point a finger directly at Joe Lieberman, said he's the man who killed it.
Yeah, the health insurance industry gave him over $1 million, and he cast the vote that killed it. So it's pretty clear.
You know, and I'm talking with Michael a few minutes ago.
By the way, he was not embarrassed by that. I mean, you know, he was from Connecticut, and Connecticut, you know, one of the major industries.
The Hartford, right.
Insurance.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because the call that I took right before you came on with Michael from New York, I was talking about how maybe things would have been different if Al Gore had been president, and I think they would have. But we can't forget that Joe Lieberman was Al Gore's running mate, which is just another weird quirk of history. So we go through it. You also give a lot of credit in the book to Wendell Potter, a friend of all of ours. If not for Wendell Potter, we wouldn't know the extent of the evils of the insurance industry. We wouldn't know about Nataline Sarkazian and the other people who were killed as a direct result of the actions of the insurance companies and a lot of Republican politicians.
Yeah, Wendell is a real hero.
He's great.
You know, in writing courses, fiction writing courses, they teach that the truly great novels are always about a character encounters a crisis. A character makes a horrible decision that's going to change his life. A character becomes a different person afterwards. That person actually changes through the arc of the novel. That's always at the core of good fiction. You know, great movies, great novels. That almost never happens in the real world.
Right.
It's like way less than 1%. Do people actually encounter crises and change fundamentally who they are?
Did with Wendell.
But Wendell Potter did. He was the head of PR for I believe it was Cigna.
Cigna and Aetna for a while too, I believe.
I'm sorry, I mixed them up in my head.
But so both of them. But both of them.
One of these big insurance companies, and he just, you know, he a couple of things. He went back to Appalachia where he was from and saw this you know, long line of people trying to get free health care from one of these Doctors Without Borders.
Remote area medical, Stan Brock, who I used to have on the show all the time. He went to one of those health care fairs and thought, here in America, people are,
exactly.
right? And that, I'm sorry, go on. I get excited.
And then there was this teenager who needed an organ transplant, and his insurance company was refusing to pay for it, and she was going to die. And it got picked up on the evening news, and suddenly it was a PR crisis, and he went and fought with them to get them to pay for her, just on the excuse that, hey, you know, sure, it's going to be an expense, but the public, you know, the PR is hurting us so badly. We should just, you know, eat this, you know. And when he finally was able to convince them to do it, that was the day that she died.
Yeah.
And I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back for Wendell. And he just said, screw this, and walked away from a 7-figure job. Or salary and huge benefits, yep. Lots and lots of money, and became a whistleblower, wrote 2 books about it, and now runs, a nonprofit that, works to promote Medicare for all and expose the excesses, shall we say, of the insurance industry.
Absolutely. And his testimony before Congress was when he, you know, he's like, all right, this is what this insurance industry is about. And it was the first time, and still to this day, the only time somebody, an insurance industry executive, came forth to tell the truth. Still to this day, nobody else has done this. So Wendell Potter is definitely a hero and still a friend of this program. I know of yours as well. So we lived with Obamacare, and it was far from perfect, but it thankfully went through. I'm alive because of it. I wouldn't have insurance otherwise, and I dealt with lung cancer. I'm now 5 years clear. So I just passed my 5-year mark a few weeks ago.
Bravo.
Thank you very much. But if not for the Affordable Care Act, I've been an independent contractor for more than 12 years now, and I wouldn't have been able to buy insurance on the open market because I had a pre-existing condition. So yep. Without that, I probably wouldn't be here today. So it was, we were able to survive on it. It was anything but affordable, but you could get by and get insurance and know that you're getting decent insurance, because at least this law put minimums in, so you know you're not buying a junk policy. If you got covered through a policy from the exchange, at least you knew you were going to be covered, and the insurance company can't say you had a pre-existing condition, so there were protections there, but it still wasn't good enough. Fast forward to now. We have Joe Biden in office. Honestly, the last president I thought would be the most progressive in my lifetime, and I don't, there's still LBJ. So, but Joe Biden, I'm pleasantly surprised at he's run his time in office so far. Very pleasantly surprised. And now we're looking at these two reconciliation bill, or the one reconciliation bill and the other soft infrastructure bill, or however you want to describe them. These two together could make a dent, and in comes Bernie Sanders again, who should have won the nomination in 2016, but go figure. He and Joe Biden are working together to try to make real change, to try to fix this stuff. And we're still fighting the old battles. So here's where we are right now. And you've got a couple of so-called Democrats, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, threatening to derail the entire thing. We still won't have Medicare for all. And it looks like the public option has all of a sudden disappeared, too, because that was supposed to be in this plan. Is it gone now?
I don't know. The final legislation, to the best of my knowledge, has not been completely written.
Right.
So, but I doubt it.
Yeah.
I'd be very surprised, because that would be a magnet to draw hundreds of millions of dollars of lobbying and negative advertising from the insurance industry. And they're fighting enough battles as it is.
But then there's another whole aspect to it, which is this pandemic we're dealing with. So in one sense, we do have single payer when it comes to COVID, because the government is the payer. It's paying for the vaccines. It's paying for, if you need the monoclonal antibody treatment, it's paying for that stuff. And funny, this way, now we still have this whole disinformation campaign where people are being told lies by a whole part of the media, which is just opposite world to me. I don't know how they exist doing this stuff. But if not for them, if not for the Fox and the Newsmax and the OANs and the crazies on the right, I think we'd be in a lot better shape than we are now, because people are getting vaccinated and people are not dying from COVID. It's the ones who are not being vaccinated who are. I thought Joe Biden delivered an amazing speech yesterday, and I love the fact that he's now pushing mandates. I wish he had done it earlier, and I wish it was even stronger than what he's saying, and not giving federal employees, for instance, a testing option. But I guess it's politics. Where do you see this going? I didn't read the end of the book. I was going to ask you half jokingly, you know, is there a happy ending? Tell me it ends well. Do we get Medicare for all? What happens at the end?
Yeah, I think we can. And I think that the way that we'll probably do it is the way that Canada did it rather than the way that Germany did it. In Canada, you had Tommy Douglas, who is every year rated the most beloved Canadian, although he's been dead for decades, Kiefer Sutherland's grandfather.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Yeah. And he was a politician from Saskatchewan. He was born back in the 20s. He went to the national parliament, you know, the federal government, and served for years as a legislator, pushing for Medicare for all. Couldn't get it passed. Finally gave up, went back to Saskatchewan. It's a low enough population state, or they call them provinces in Canada, that you can do retail politics there. When I lived in Vermont, a friend of mine who's a Vermont politician once made the comment to me that Bernie Sanders has shaken the hands of everybody in Vermont at least three times. And it's probably an understatement. It's definitely true. Because, you know, it's a small state, 600,000 people. You do retail politics. The same thing was true of Saskatchewan. So Tommy Douglas just went on this, you know, whistle-stop tour for a year or more, going into people's homes and telling them about single payer and how we could do this. And he got it passed. And it worked so well that the provinces around them were like, hey, I want that. And within a decade, it had spread all the way across Canada. And then the federal government jumped in to say, OK, we're going to backstop you guys and provide a backdoor payment system so that if somebody from Saskatchewan gets sick in Toronto, Saskatchewan can reimburse the Toronto system and all that kind of stuff. But it's still every province has their own system, and they're all slightly different. Some cover vision, some don't, some cover dental, some, you know, it's like that. And here in the United States, Vermont and California both passed legislation for single payer health care. It's been signed by the governor in Vermont, Peter Shumlin, when he was governor. Mm-hmm. And the problem that they ran into, and they didn't really realize this until then, was that back in 65, when LBJ was doing Medicare, they wanted to put a provision in there to block the southern states from taking Medicare money and then refusing to spend it on black people.
Oh my God.
There's like this kind of audit trail from federal money down to the individual. And so because of that, if Vermont wanted to do a single payer system, they had to give up all their Medicare and Medicaid money. They just couldn't take it, which was billions of dollars. It would have broken Vermont.
Sure.
And so the battle that we have to fight is for what are referred to. I mean, there's all kinds of fancy acronyms, ERISA and all this other stuff. But the bottom line is, you know, if you're calling your legislators or you're bringing it up at a town hall meeting or sending an email or whatever, the message is we want Congress to pass Medicare, Medicaid waivers for the states so that the states can do their own single payer healthcare systems.
Huh. Okay.
It could be a 3-page piece of legislation. It's not a big deal. And it's been introduced over and over and over again. It never gets any publicity because it's not sexy. I mean,
right.
You know, we're talking
right.
Bureaucratic stuff. Waivers? Really?
Right.
But that would open the door.
Huh.
And then I think it would be inevitable. Just
oh,
like it was.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, and unfortunately, we're dealing with, you know, what I call opposite world, which is this faction just making shit up and pretending it as fact. And, you know, it's what it's like I always say, I'll talk to a Republican anytime, but they have to agree to the basic facts. Sky is blue, grass is green, and most of them won't. But Joe Walsh, for instance, I had on the show last week because he's been making noises like I was wrong. The former congressman, Joe Walsh, not the guitar player. And he was reasonable on some things. We had some common ground. He knows Trump is Trump and what's going on with that faction of the Republican Party. But when it came to health care, he doesn't think everybody that health care should be a human right. He also doesn't think that everybody has the right to a living wage. And so therein lies the problem. When they won't just agree to that, like human beings have certain unalienable rights, that I don't know how you move the needle. And I, maybe it's a generational thing. I have great faith in the young people. Our generation didn't do it. Maybe they can. Is that the right way to look at it?
I think it's going to happen. Yeah. Young people are going to be our salvation. And this is also, a national healthcare system would also help promote a Green New Deal because so many people are sick from pollution from fossil fuels. And if we started having to pay for that through our taxes via, a national healthcare system, we could save money in our healthcare system by greening our infrastructure.
Of course. Well, of course, it all makes sense once you cut through all the lies and the noise. So anyway, Tom Hartmann, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. I have so many more questions, but I guess I'll have to save them for next time. The book is The Hidden History of American Healthcare, Why Sickness Bankrupts You and Makes Others Insanely Rich. I hate that that's true, but it is. And we need to change it. Tom Hartmann, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Nicole. It's great seeing you again.
You too.
Thank you.
Thanks again. Bye-bye. And there you go, Tom Hartmann. And that wraps up things for this week. What a week, huh? Again, if you want something heartwarming to get out of the 9/11 mindset and the depression that I think a lot of us are feeling right about now, do, if you have Apple TV, sign up for the free trial or something, because this weekend, Come From Away, they're showing the musical. Again, based on the airlines, all the planes that were in the air when the towers were hit that were diverted to Gander, Newfoundland, and the stories we learned about the people there. And read the book, The Day the World Came to Town. And Jim Defeaty will be on in the next week or two to talk a bit about that. All right. Well, and that's it. That's a week. We'll stick a fork in it. Thank you for listening, everybody. Until next week. We've got good stuff coming up next week, too. What do I have? Let's see. Katrina Vandenhoevel from The Nation will be here on Monday. Jason Leopold will be here on Tuesday. My old friend Bill Mumy and Angela Cartwright from Lost in Space. I've never met Angela, but Bill is a dear, dear old friend of mine. They'll be here on Wednesday. So, I have stuff to look forward to next week. So that's always a good thing. Thank you for listening. As always, I'll leave you with the news. Have a great weekend, everyone. And I don't know what to say about 9/11 again. It's there. It will always be there. And nothing's been fixed. I guess we just live with the knowledge and work to make things better. Some people are. I don't know. All right. Until Monday, have a great weekend, everyone. Hopefully you'll take my advice and get some heartwarming stuff out of the memories. All right. Thanks again. I'll see you Monday. Bye. If I can hit the right button. Come on. I always want to go for the smooth segue, and then I go to hit the button and the mouse doesn't work. All right, here we go. See ya.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
My message to unvaccinated Americans is this. What more is there to wait for? What more do you need to see? We've made vaccinations free, safe, and convenient. The vaccine is FDA approval. Over 200 million Americans have gotten at least one shot. We've been patient, but our patience is wearing thin, and your refusal has cost all of us. So please do the right thing, but just don't take it from me. Listen to the voices of unvaccinated Americans who are lying in hospital beds, taking their final breath saying, if only I'd gotten vaccinated. If only. It's a tragedy. Please don't let it become yours.
President Joe Biden on Thursday expressed frustration about where we stand as a nation in the fight to eradicate COVID-19. So he's taking action, announcing a 6-step plan, along with a couple of new executive orders, to get the rest of the country vaccinated and finally stop the spread of COVID. First, a new vaccination mandate for federal workers and 17 million healthcare workers at institutions that take Medicare and Medicaid funding. Also, the Labor Department will draft a rule requiring businesses with 100 or more workers to require proof of vaccination or undergo weekly coronavirus testing. That's point one of Biden's 6-part strategy, vaccinating the unvaccinated with mandates for workers, public and private. Number two, further protecting the vaccinated through booster shots. More guidance coming soon from the CDC and FDA. Point number three, keeping schools open. Biden took aim at Republican governors who are working against a solution, like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who's now saying he will withhold salaries from school officials who put mask mandates in place, even though the courts ruled against him already twice on this issue. Biden also said he'll require that 300,000 educators in federal Head Start programs be vaccinated, and he'll call on governors to require vaccinations for all school teachers and staff. Number four, increasing testing. The president also announced a new partnership with some retailers who'll be selling at-home rapid tests at cost. Number five, economic recovery. President Biden announcing that his administration would expand the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program to allow for small businesses to borrow up to $2 million, that's up from the current $500,000, in low-interest, long-term loans if their sales have been impacted by COVID-19. And the sixth and final part of the six-part plan, improving care for those who are infected, increasing availability of new medicines, quote, recommended by real doctors, not conspiracy theorists. He's talking about increasing the number of free monoclonal antibody treatments by 50% around the nation. And he also said the Department of Defense will double the number of military health teams available to help overburdened hospitals around the country. And to all that, I say thank you, Mr. President. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Board of Education on Thursday voted to make the coronavirus vaccination mandatory for all children 12 and older in the Los Angeles public school system. Hopefully the rest of the nation will follow. About an hour or two before the president spoke, Attorney General Merrick Garland took the microphone to announce that the Department of Justice filed a lawsuit against the state of Texas, seeking to block their ban on abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. Attorney General Merrick Garland referred to that as the legislation's, quote, bounty hunter element. He said the Texas law was, quote, clearly unconstitutional under longstanding Supreme Court precedent. Police in Washington, D.C. will reinstall a fence around the U.S. Capitol to boost security during next week's planned Justice for J6 rally. That's what they're calling it. It's by supporters of the 600 or so people who were charged for their roles in the deadly January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. And finally, Saturday marks the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. 20 years. Although for some of us, it feels like it was just yesterday. President Biden will mark the occasion with visits to Ground Zero in New York City, the Pentagon, and the memorial outside of Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where United Flight 93 was forced down by passengers. The attacks killed 2,977 people and changed our world.
And I've seen your flag on the marble arch, and love is not a victory march. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah. Hallelujah.
All units be advised, the North Tower is leaning. Move your operations north of the tower.
Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God! They're both down now. It's just a huge cloud of smoke.
Maybe there is a God above, but all I've ever learned from love was how to shoot somebody who outdrew you. And it's not a cry that you hear at night. It's not somebody who's seen the light. It's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah.